Okay, welcome everyone. Coming here after lunch. Hope we don't fall into the food coma for the 400 level session. My name is Brian Nice, and I will be doing the session entitled Link Deep Dive, Edge Media Connectivity with ICE. This is actually a really fun deck to work with, and I guess fun is a relative term. I guess, for me it's fun, but again, like I told the last class or the last session that we did, I don't really get out much. So, the objective for us in this session is to talk a little bit about what the AV Edge server is in Link, and really, what does it actually do with regards to media flow? I mean, that's the crux of what we want to focus on in this session. How do we find our optimal media path? Understanding that media paths and media traversal are complicated enough, right? But we now want to understand how does the Link client and the Link infrastructure discover and find what our optimal media path is for connectivity between the endpoints that want to make a call. And most importantly, how do I read these log files that I get? Because there's a wealth of information inside of the log files that Link can provide for us. Unfortunately, it can be a little intimidating when you open up the log files, especially if you open it up and are immediately greeted with lots of red, because red's generally a bad thing, right? So being able to, interpret the logs and understand what we're seeing helps us to, better understand how the product is supposed to work. And from my perspective, when it comes to troubleshooting, if I can't properly explain how it's supposed to work, I'm going to be hopeless at trying to troubleshoot it. Because I don't know what I'm supposed to be looking for, so I don't know what looks incorrect. So it's interesting, well, at least to me and a few of my other cohorts that are on my team. It's pretty interesting in how we establish these media paths through Edge. We want to help you understand the call flow process when an Edge server is involved. And all told, this should help you be able to troubleshoot media connectivity scenarios that are involving the Edge environment. That's a good thing. Edge is complicated enough. Introducing media components into it makes it a little bit more challenging. So we want to make sure that we provide you guys with the tool sets that you need to be able to troubleshoot and debug this if it's not working properly. So here's the agenda that I have laid out for you guys. First, we're going to talk about the problems that are available to us when we're talking about media connectivity. Right? Establishing a media path seems really simple, right? User A, which is Alice, wants to call user B, which is Bob. So why don't Alice and Bob just talk to each other, right? Why don't they just talk directly to each other? Makes perfect sense until we start throwing all kinds of stuff in between Alice and Bob. Things like firewalls and NAT and things along those lines. So what are some of the problems that we're faced with media connectivity? What are the protocols that we use to establish this media connectivity? And this is where we get to throw a barrage of letters at you in the form of ICE and STUN and TURN. We will go through an actual trace of establishing a media session so that you guys can see start to finish what it looks like when we establish a media session through Edge. We'll finish up with an understanding of different call flow types. Right, what happens when we're dealing with not only calls in the Link infrastructure, but what happens when we federate with another organization that's running Link? What if they're not running Link? What if they're running OCS, maybe 2007R2? Maybe they're still running 2007R1. What does that do from a call flow perspective? And what about this wonderful 10,000 port range that we have, the 50,000 to 59,999 port range that is a source of great heartburn for many folks that are doing implementations of Edge? What is that port range doing? Why do we need it? We'll cover that all when we get to the call flow section. And then we'll wrap up with some Q&A. A few housekeeping items before we get going. Would certainly appreciate if you have your cell phones that you set them to vibrate. Also, don't forget towards the end of the session, and I will remind you that we want to have your evals filled out. And if you do have questions to ask, we have microphones right in the center. If you can make your way over to the mics and use those, that'll save me from having to repeat the question for the folks that are doing the recording. So having said that, here's a little slide about me. My name's Brian Nice again. I live in Southern California. I have been working on I am LCS OCS and Link since way back in the Exchange 2000 days when we had the IAM and Presence components that were built into Exchange. I work in Microsoft Consulting Services Voice Center of Excellence. So I do Link all day, all the time. So that's why I have so much fun with doing Edge, because I have nothing better to do. So very, very important housekeeping slide here. This is a 400-level session. It's not meant to be taken lightly. Okay? A 400-level session is an expert-level session. We are going to be diving very deep into how the Edge environment works with regards to media flows. If you're not prepared for a 400-level session, I certainly welcome you to stay. But if you're not prepared for a 400-level session, you still have time to jump out and find another session if you so desire. We are going to limit this to media scenarios only. Okay, I will talk basic SIP stuff so that we can get an understanding of signaling, but our core focus of this class, of this session, is on media. So I assume that you have a basic understanding of SIP and a basic understanding of RTP, which is the real-time protocol. Also assume that you have a basic understanding of link server roles. If you don't know what an edge server is, this will be a difficult hour and 15 minutes for you. Okay, so just gonna let you know up front. Okay, so make sure you have a good understanding of what the link server roles are, and that you have a basic understanding of what a typical link topology would look like. Okay, we still have some people here, so that's encouraging. We didn't all get up and run out in droves screaming, so that's fantastic. So let's cover some terms and acronyms so that we're all speaking the same lingo as we go throughout this presentation. First off, we have the concept of a candidate. You're going to hear me refer to candidates a lot. Candidates are simply possible combinations of IP addresses and ports that we can use to establish our media channel. As we'll come to discover, our candidates can be UDP candidates. They can be TCP candidates. It all depends on what scenarios we're looking through, and we'll cover as we go through this deck. We have ICE. It's a really cool concept. That's not the last time you're going to hear that joke, by the way. Okay, so you should probably laugh more than once. It'd be helpful. Okay, ICE stands for Interactive Connectivity Establishment. ICE is the magic that we're going to use to perform our media traversals. TURN stands for Traversal Using Relay NAT. If you can't remember anything about TURN, simply remember relay, and you'll be good to go. Okay? Because when we get into logs and we start poking around, you're going to see that word relay pop up, and that should trigger a little response in your head that goes, oh, relay, TURN, got it. Okay? So keep that in mind. And then we have STUN, which originally stood for Simple Traversal of UDP through NAT, until they realized that we could use it for more than just UDP, like TCP, for example. So they figured that probably wasn't such a great name. We should probably call it something that would include the ability to do more than just UDP. So we call it Session Traversal Utilities for NAT. So we have the capability of using STUN now for both UDP and TCP. Fantastic. So let's start with one of the basic things that we need to fully understand so that we can appreciate the way that ICE, STUN, and TURN are going to help us. And that starts with NAT. Everybody interacts with NAT somewhere in their lifetime, you know, of being in IT, whether you know it or not. Network address translation is the ability for us to translate one or more of our internal addresses to one external address, right? So when I'm at my house and I have my home wireless network and I have a couple of PCs that are on the network, I have a couple of slates that are on the network, right? We all have the capability of being able to go out and surf the web and do our business with one public IP address that was provided by my ISP, right? We do that all through the magic of NAT. Additionally, NAT provides a little bit of a security component for us as well, right? Because with NAT, typically the way that NAT works is we're going to allow connections that go from the inside to the outside just fine, but we're not going to allow stuff to come back in, right? If somebody wants to initiate a connection inbound to my home network, we're not going to let that happen, right? We're going to block that request. So connections that come in from the internet get blocked. Connections that go out to the internet are allowed. Makes perfect sense and helps save on IP addresses until such time as we can get something like IPv6 deployed. Obviously, there's a bit of a trade-off to that, right? Yes, it does block attackers from harming your system. That's good. It also blocks incoming signaling and media for connections that I have not already established outbound. That's bad, right? So here I am sitting at home. I've got my client, you know, signed in. I want somebody to call me. Well, if I'm not initiating the connection outbound, when they try to bring that connection into my network, sorry, no, not allowed. Don't know who you are. See ya. So that becomes a bit of a problem for us, and we have to have a way to get around that. Now, obviously, an easy way to get around that is, just put a public IP address on my machine. Not a very practical way to get around it, right? So we needed ways to solve the problem. It gets worse when you take it outside of the home environment, right? When you take it outside of the home environment and you get into the corporate world, suddenly we enter into scenarios that introduce things like a DMZ, or a demilitarized zone, also called a perimeter network, as you see on the slide. So if you take a peek here, on the left-hand side, we have the all-powerful internet, right? On the right-hand side, we have our work machines. And then we have double layers of firewalls here, right? We have an outside firewall or an outer firewall. And typically, his job is to make sure that he allows traffic, selective traffic, of course, to come into the perimeter network, but blocks traffic that goes to the internal network, just like your home net kind of does, right? Then you have an inner firewall that, again, is responsible for allowing traffic to come into this perimeter network, but blocking traffic that goes all the way throughout to the internet. So now suddenly we end up with this situation where we've compounded our problem, right? Because we don't just have one layer we've got to get through. We've got multiple layers that we have to get through. And obviously in this type of scenario where we're blocking these unsolicited type requests, the ability for me to establish media just kind of goes out the window, as it were, you know, without the help of something like ICE, Stun, and Turn. How do we solve the problem? Well, before we can establish media, we have to establish a signaling path, right? Voice 101, right? We have a signaling path, we have a media stream. They don't always follow the same path, but you need them both, right? Signaling is going to set up that channel for me to be able to make the call and exchange all of that information that I need to exchange. And then there's the actual media path, which is the RTP stream or the actual voice data that's going to flow between the endpoints. So how do we solve the signaling solution? Well, that one's actually pretty straightforward with our edge server, right? We deploy our edge server. As you can see here on the left side, we have a private computer. On the right side, we have an internet computer. And we stick an access edge server or an edge server in the DMZ, right? And its job, it has interfaces into both segments, right? It has connectivity to the public internet, and it has connectivity to the internal network, and it has the ability to proxy requests on my behalf. So signaling is easy in that regard, because my client connects to the Access Edge server, which has a public IP, or it could be NATed, but for the purposes of our discussion, we've got a public IP that we hit. The Access Edge then hops it to whatever my next hop system is, which could be a director, or it could be a front-end pool, which then routes over to the end user that we want to talk to. This is a very static type model, though, right? And it works great for signaling, right? This kind of model wouldn't work so well for media flow. So while this solves the signaling problem, and this pins up our signaling channel, it doesn't really help us when it comes to media. We need something better than what you see here to be able to find our media paths. Yes, we can find our Access Edge server using a standard SRV lookup, or we could just manually point the client straight at the Access Edge server as well. One other little side note, when I refer to Access Edge, that is one of the three roles that are found inside of an Edge server, right? Access Edge server, AV conferencing server, or AV Edge server, and web conferencing server. They all run on the same physical box, right? I'm just speaking of that one particular role because the Access Edge role is what handles our signaling for us. So really, I mean, what's the big deal about NAT? I mean, I kind of alluded to the fact that NAT's a problem, but why is it a problem? Well, signaling is easy because we're using TCP, and TCP is going over the access edge, and it's very clearly defined where that needs to go. UDP, however, that's what we prefer for our media stream. Why? Because UDP is stateless. It's connectionless. There's less overhead, right? Think about it. If I send TCP traffic and some of that traffic gets dropped, what happens? TCP retransmits it, right? Well, if I'm listening to a voice conversation and a little bit of it drops, I don't want to hear it again 5 seconds later. Okay, if it dropped, it dropped. Sorry. I don't want to hear that conversation come back at me 5 seconds from now. So I'd much prefer to go over UDP rather than TCP. So our preference is UDP. UDP media will flow over separate channels. There is a capability for us to use TCP, which we'll discuss in a little bit. Now, pre-ICE endpoints, if I don't have an ICE-capable client, kind of looks like this. So I do my initial invite to the edge, and this is over SIP. And the candidates that I show are the candidates that I have available to me on my local workstation. Right? So you can see here, on the left side, my home machine, I have a candidate of A. That's the local IP address of my machine, right? That's actually assigned to my workstation. You have the person on the right side, that's the work machine. He has a local IP address on his machine, which we have labeled W. Now, the purple signifies UDP in this instance, as we'll see in a little bit. The problem comes from the fact that if they were trying to connect to each other just with those IP addresses, the chances of that happening are zero in this scenario. Right? The only way that this is going to work is if A, we happen to both be on the same IP subnet, right, which means we're both internal, which kind of invalidates the scenario that you see here, or it would mean that we both have publicly routable IP addresses, which, albeit could be a situation, is not a very likely situation in most scenarios. So that's why NAT traversal becomes a problem, because we can't send media between A and W here, because we have no connectivity. We're both using private IP addresses, and we have no way to route between the two. So the solution to this is the combination of stun turn and ICE. So again, we have our diagram here that shows our home user on the left, our work user on the right. Now, this is a simplified diagram in the sense that we've left out some pieces like, you know, between the access proxy, there's a next hop of a director or a front end. Okay, we're focusing on media here. So just as I tell my students when I teach masters, just there's a little button that says, I believe. Just press the I believe button, and believe me, it works. Now we'll talk about specifically these media aspects. So first thing that we do to solve this issue is we add a media relay component, which we call the AV Edge Server in Link. There's a component in the AV Edge Server that's called Stun. And Stun's job is to reflect the NAT addresses during the negotiation process or during the candidate selection process. So, for example, as you can see here, my home user, he has a local IP address of A. Stun is going to reflect two candidates, B and E. The B candidate is UDP. The E candidate is TCP. This is the NATed IP address that it saw when I made the connection to the Stun server. Right? So when I connected to the AV Edge server, a request came in, and he said, ooh, that request is from this public IP address. Because, right, I got NATed when I went out from my home network. As part of the SDP, which we'll look at in a minute, Stun's going to reflect that back to me to be able to say, hey, by the way, did you know you can be reached at this IP address because it's your NATed public IP? So Stun is going to reflect that back to me. Right? So reflection, that's another important piece to keep in your mind. When we talk about Stun, Stun is all about reflecting an address that you already have. Turn's job is to relay. Remember? Turn, relay. Right? Think about it, too. Turn, here, there. I know that's going to play really well for the people that's listening to audio and don't see video, right? But, you know, turn is just about that, right? I get data from this end, and I turn, and I send it that way. That's the job of a turn server. It relays media packets. So as a result of this initial candidate selection that I'm doing here, I get additional candidates that show up, right? So let me back that up here a second so you can see. First, we start with B and E. That's my local workstation on the left, the home user that was reflected by a stun. On the right, these are candidates that are being reflected by Turn. Turn is actually going to allocate information from the AV Edge server, which means that the address that you see here is, in fact, the public IP address of the AV Edge server itself. That means that because that shows up, and again, you see C and D and X and Y, right? C and D are the turn candidates for the user on the left, for the home user. X and Y are the turn candidates for the user on the right, that's the work user. That means that these are additional addresses at which I can be reached. Now, as a result, of course, if the client sends traffic to that AV Edge server, the AV Edge server has to turn around and send that traffic somewhere else. That's the purpose of turn. ICE is the wrapper around all of this that facilitates exchanging these candidates and has logic in it to determine what our optimal media path is going to be. So ICE is the wrapper or the magic that makes all of this happen. STUN and TURN are the protocols underneath that are actually reflecting or allocating addresses depending on the type of scenario that we're dealing with. One other note to clarify on this slide. Again, in the middle you see the access proxy, and then underneath that a separate box called STUN TURN server, also known as AV Edge. We're breaking that out as logical components, right? They will all be running on the same physical box, or the same VM if you virtualize it, right? Those roles do not get split out. That's all running on the same box. So we break it out for logical purposes, but it doesn't operate that way. They're just separate services that all run on the same box. All of these protocols are IETF standards. This is not anything proprietary or magical that we've come up with from Microsoft's perspective. This is all based on IETF standards. So, which clients are going to be ICE clients? I mean, we've got lots of endpoints here in the Link environment. Which ones are ICE capable, right? Well, of course, the Link client itself, we know that that's ICE capable, right? Because you're able to sign in over the internet through the edge and establish media flow, and it all magically works without you requiring a VPN. And you're able to establish your media flow. So we'll go ahead and stick a cool little ICE cube there to let you know that the Link client is, in fact, an ICE client. How about the next one here? This is Link Web App. So quick poll, this is the interactive part to make sure you're not falling asleep. How many of you think the Link Web App is, in fact, going to be an ICE client? Okay, we had a few hands, okay? First thing that'll pop into your head, I'm sure, is, well, Link Web App doesn't do media, right? So it couldn't possibly be an ICE client. Sure it can. What happens if you're in Link Web App and you're going to share your desktop out? Yeah, kudos, guys. Good job. You share your desktop out, you have to install a little plugin, right? When you install that plugin, you just installed an ICE client. So you've just made Link Web App an ICE client. So yes, Link Web App is capable of being an ICE client for the purposes of doing desktop sharing. Gotcha. The Tanjay or Aries phone devices? Makes perfect sense that those are going to be ICE clients. How about the Roundtable? Right, the little funky upside-down Starship Enterprise thing, right? Roundtable isn't actually an ICE client, right? The Roundtable is just a fancy, expensive webcam. It's a good one, right? Don't get me wrong, but it's just that. It's a webcam. It connects via USB to the presenter's machine, and the presenter's machine, that's the ICE client. There's no media that's actually going directly to the Roundtable device itself. So that's not a STUN client, or excuse me, an ICE client. Front-end servers. What do we think? Front-end servers? Yeah? Sure. Front-end servers are ICE capable, and that's not just if they were co-locating roles that make sense, right? Like AV conferencing and mediation server, you kind of think of those right off the top of your head and go, of course, it's co-located on the front end. But regardless of that, front-end servers also run things like the audio test service, conferencing auto attendance, right? Those are capable of traversing with ICE as well. So the front-end server is most definitely an ICE client. AV conferencing, that's probably one of the most obvious ones on the slide besides the Link client itself. Yep, that's a nice client. As well as mediation servers, right? Mediation servers are ICE clients. How about SBAs, the survivable branch appliances, right? By nature of what they are, they run a mediation server role. So, yep, those guys are, in fact, ICE clients. How about the SBCs, right? The session border controllers. What do we think about those guys? They look like they're beefing up to be ICE clients? No, not really. SBCs, no. How about gateways? Right, a gateway, that's an ICE client, right? Nah, gateways aren't ICE clients either. Incidentally, you might wonder, well, of course a gateway is going to be an ICE client. What if you do media bypass, right? Well, if you do media bypass, the implication is you're local to the gateway. Why would it need to do ICE? You're not traversing edge. If you come in through the edge at that point, you wouldn't be doing media bypass because you're not on the same segment as the media gateway. Ergo, you're going to go through the mediation server. No need to be an ICE client. Exchange UM, Sure, Exchange UM is aware of ICE so that we can connect in and get to our auto attendants and voicemail and all that good stuff. Directors, not so much. Directors are really just signaling hops for us, right? So generally, and as you see in this screenshot, all of our signaling would traverse from client to edge to director to front end and vice versa. So the director is more of a next hop for signaling and not for media. How about edge server? This one's a tricky one, right? Because the edge server itself, although it participates in this whole process, the edge server itself never actually is an endpoint, right? From a, I'm going to initiate connection out or something to that effect. So it is capable of doing the stun and turn, right? Which you see here, the stun, the lightning bolt and the turn being the arrow kind of thing. And it's kind of a soft ICE client, right? So there you go. It's, yeah. Okay, so the details of ICE. Five phases that we're going to go through here to talk about. The first phase is provisioning. During logon, your client needs to figure out where the MRAS server is or how we get access to this wonderful edge AV edge server. So we have a turn provisioning and credential component that we're going to deal with during login. That, again, happens during login and every 8 hours after that. So if you are, decide you get out of this session and you're like, oh, I want to go trace this and see if I can find what Brian showed, and your link client's already running and you just turn on logging, you're not going to see this. You have to turn on logging and sign out and sign back in. Well, unless you stare at your computer for about 8 hours, then you might see it. But you probably want to sign back out and sign in again so that you can see the turn provisioning, because that only happens at logon. When you establish a call, we have four distinct phases we need to go through. Address discovery, or allocation. Address exchange, which we'll see when we look at SIP invites and the 200 OKs that we get back from those SIP invites. We have connectivity checks that have to happen. And finally, we have what's called candidate promotion, which is where we finally agree on what the final set of candidates are going to be. So let's talk about credentials, the provisioning of credentials. So we have our endpoint. We do our register. Now, notice that when we do our register, again, as we talked about the signaling channel, I go from link endpoint to edge, edge to whatever my next hop is, which in this case is a front-end server. The front-end server authenticates me. Edge does not authenticate you, right? The front-end server authenticates me and responds back with provisioning information. The next thing that I do as a client is I say, sweet, I got logged in. I'm going to send a SIP service request because I need to get credentials to that MRAS server, right? Because not everybody can use the AV Edge server. Right? We don't want to just open that thing up on the internet and say, bring it on, come on, anybody want to use me, that's fine. No, you have to have credentials to be able to use the AV Edge component. So we send a SIP service request, and in that request, one of the components we send is our location. In this case, I send location internet so that we know I'm coming in through the edge. That's how I know that I'm outside, or how Link knows that I'm outside. The Link front-end server, on behalf of me, asked for credentials to the MRAS service via what's called MRAS, or Media Relay Authentication Service. It gives me access to the AV Edge via MRAS. Now, we've got this service request from the front-end to the edge, the 200 OK, the response that comes back to my client. Well, you might look at this and go, wow, that seems kind of... Seems kind of counterproductive. I mean, why can't I just ask the edge server for credentials myself, right? Why do I need to go to the access edge to the front end and have the front end do it for me? Why don't I just do it for myself? Well, the main reason we can't do that is when I send that service request in to the access edge, how does the access edge know whether I'm authorized to use the AV edge service or not? He doesn't know. How does he even know who I am? He can't authenticate me. Right? Because think about it, the access edge or the edge server, it's out in a perimeter network. It's not part of your production Active Directory domain, production Active Directory forest. It doesn't know who I am. All it can do is look at my SIP domain and go, oh yeah, that's brian@contoso.com. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Here you go. That's a SIP domain that I support. I'm going to pass that on to the front end and let him figure it out. Right? So the edge isn't going to bother to check authentication because it can't. In this instance, the AV edge trusts the front-end server, right? Why does it trust it? Well, because they're both defined in the topology, inside of Link. You went into Topology Builder, you defined the front-end server, you defined the edge server, and on the front-end pool inside of Topology Builder, you configured media relay, right? You basically went to the pool and you ticked the little checkbox that says associate media components, and you selected the edge server or edge pool. That built the trust relationship between that front-end pool and that AV edge server. So as a result, when the front-end server says, yo, AV edge auth, MRAS, I need some credentials, Brian wants some. The AV edge auth or the MRAS service goes, okay, I don't know who Brian is, but I trust you. And because you're asking on his behalf, here you go. Here's the credential information that you need. And you see, I get back the name, ports. These will be ingrained in your head, UDP 3478, TCP 443. A username, a password, and a duration, 480 minutes or 8 hours by default. Credentials for conferencing work much the same way. Conferencing in the sense that, say, you have a user, an external user that's coming in to join a conference. Same idea. SIP invite goes out. Again, even though the user may be an anonymous user, it doesn't matter because we trust the front-end server. They made it past the front-end server, meaning that they are getting into a valid conference. So the front-end server can request the information and pass it on back to the client. No big deal. So let's take a look at what it looks like in the logs. So what I'm showing you here, this is a snooper trace. Snooper is a utility that's found in the resource kit. So if you don't have the Link resource kit deployed, it's a good idea to deploy it. Once you've installed it anywhere, you can go and grab this executable. It stands alone, right? So just go grab snooper.exe. It's going to be in the program files, Link server, reskit tracing folder. Grab snooper. It's a great utility to use to be able to look at these logs. And then when you turn logging on in your Link clients, we're going to write that log out to your user profile directory tracing. Right, so for me, it's under my users folder slash Brian Nice slash tracing, and that's where the log file gets written. So here's my first log, and the first thing that I'm going to search for is MRAS. And what you're going to see here when I look at MRAS is three things. First, I should see, if this is working right, I should see three messages that come back. I see this is the 200 OK response. Right, this is the 200 OK response that came back to my original SIP register that I did to sign in to Link. And then I have the service messages, the service request and response. So let's look at these in greater detail. Right, so here's the first one. Let me move this over here just a little bit so we can see what we're doing. So if I scroll down here, and I'm not going to spend a ton of time here, but this just kind of shows that this is getting me my provisioning information. Right, so I can see I've got a customized help URL here. I have a privacy statement URL. I have P2P app sharing encryption set and a location policy. And so this is all provisioning information that happens during the initial sign-in. Right, so this is basically in-band provisioning of all policies for my Link client. What am I allowed to do? What am I not allowed to do? Right, so we look up here a little bit higher. You know, I've got a maximum photo size of 30. Music on hold is turned off, and so forth, right? So lots of good provisioning information that we see. And if I scroll down a lot, and sorry if some of you get seasick while I'm scrolling, you will see in that initial provisioning request, there's the MRAS URI. So first and foremost, this lets me know that I'm properly configured, at least from the pool's perspective, that the pool believes that there's an edge server out there. I don't know if I can talk to the edge server yet. I don't know if the front-end server can talk to the edge server yet, but I know that somebody went into Topology Builder, and they went to the pool, and they ticked associate external media, and they picked an edge pool. And it resolved back the name of the server, which, as you can see, these are some really funky names that we use here at Microsoft. Great. Now I do my SIP service request. Now, if you look at the SIP service request, you can see that there's the duration, 480. There's my identity, right? It is a credentials request. So this is me asking the front end to give me credentials for the edge. In my 200 OK, I get a response back that shows exactly that. There it is. Just like we saw on the slide. So I can see here, this is the public name of my AV Edge. There's my ports, 3478 UDP, 443 TCP, duration 480. I asked for 8 hours, I got 8 hours. Sweet. So what does all that mean besides, wow, it's kind of cool to poke around in a log? Well, what that now tells me is not only is it properly provisioned, I have proper communication between my front-end server and my edge server. All right? That happens over TCP port 5062. And invariably, some firewall admin somewhere is going to block that port. Right? So you're going to get an MRAS URI in your client, and then it's not going to be able to connect to the MRAS server. And then you start making phone calls, and you get boop, boop, boop. And you're like, when's this thing going to connect? Well, it's trying to connect and get you credentials from Edge, and the front-end server's not able to talk to the Edge server. So this would let me check and see that that's working, and it also lets me see that the ports are what I expect them to be, right? Which the ports should be 3478 UDP and 443 TCP. All right, switch back over to the deck here. So address discovery, great. Now we've gotten provisioned. Next step in the process is I need to discover what addresses I'm allowed to talk with. All right, well, here again, on the left side here, we have our endpoint. We have a NAT firewall. So maybe this is me at home. We'll just use that as a simple example. So obviously, I'm going to have an IP address on my network card. That's kind of a no-brainer, right? So whatever my local IP address is, there you go. That's the one that I'm going to connect to, or I'm going to list as an address that's available to be connected with. Allocate UDP, allocate TCP. This is a stun reflection for us. And again, remember that in this instance, right, we're being reflected back one candidate for UDP and one candidate for TCP. So that's why the purple one, that's B, that's my UDP stun candidate. And the D, the yellow one, is TCP stun candidate. So that was reflected back via MRAS. I also have ports that are allocated on the MRAS itself, which are my turn IP addresses. That's denoted by the C and E items that you see on the far right. So my client collects all this information and I put it into my candidate list. So I see that I have, in this instance, five different candidates that I can use, A, B, C, D, and E. That includes my stun reflections, and that includes the turn allocations that are on the AV Edge server itself. Now, in the scenario of desktop share and file transfer, it's a little bit different, right? Because obviously we still go through the local IP address and so forth, but in this instance, we only reflect or we only show TCP candidates. And that's because file transfer and desktop sharing operate on TCP only, right? These mechanisms don't have the capability of using UDP. You know, desktop sharing uses RDP over RTP, right? So it's a remote desktop protocol, so we need TCP for that. Other addresses that might show up, well, you might have another network card, right? Maybe you're running virtualization software and you've got like four network cards in your machine and each of them have an IP address and some of them are like the dreaded 169.254 address or whatever. Well, you'll see them in your candidate lists because Link doesn't know any better. It's an IP. We're going to add it in as a candidate list. You may have a router that's UPnP aware that can add a port map for you. Not common to see that, but you might. So once we get all of these addresses together from one side, well, then what do we do with them? Well, the next logical step is, well, I've collected my candidates. I need to exchange them with you because I want to call you, right? So I'm telling you where I am, and you're telling me where you are. And that way we can figure out how we're going to establish this media channel. So here we go. SIP invite. Now, again, for the purposes of what we're looking at here, on the left, my endpoint, say that's me at home. That could be me at Starbucks. I'm there quite frequently, right? I have my NAT firewall. I have my Edge environment. On the right side, we have another user that we're talking to, right? Maybe this is me talking to one of my colleagues that happens to be over in Europe, you know, as an example. So he has his own IP address, his own firewall, and maybe he's got his own Edge server, right? Because I'm on the North American pool, he's on the Europe pool, and we have, you know, each have our own respective Edge servers that we're dealing with. Okay, so I send the SIP invite out. Yes, there are some components in the middle here that you just press the I believe button for, okay? So SIP invite goes out, and I include my list of candidates. There they are, A, B, C, D. The client on the right collects his candidates and sends them back to me as part of a 183 session progress. This is also referred to as early media. So during the 183 session progress, I get all of these candidates that come back to me. Now, this is when we actually, you know, during the early media, we actually will establish a media connection, right? And that's such that when somebody picks up the phone and we say, hello, we don't miss that, right? If we didn't do early media and they picked up the phone, we'd have to wait for media to establish. Well, by the time that happens, they've said hello and nobody there, click, and you hang up on them, right? So the whole idea of early media is by the time they pick up that handset, there's already a media path established. It may not be the best one, but there is one. Right? We better have some media than it's better to have some media than no media. Right? That's the job of early media. A 200 okay comes back with the candidate selection, and then we're going to promote to final candidates as we'll see on the next couple slides. But before we do that, I want to switch back over and start doing some log analysis on candidates. Now, this particular trace that I have is a capture between two of my colleagues that work in the COE with me, Thomas Binder. So those of you that know anything about Edge, Thomas pretty much is the man, and one of my friends, Amit Bhatia. So this is a call between those two. And what I want to do is I'm going to do a search for candidate. And there's a couple of things that I want to look at. First off, when I look at candidate that you see here, let's just ignore that first SIP 200. That's really just a remnant of the conversation you don't need to focus on right now. This is the initial invite that I'm sending out. So Thomas is calling Amit. So this is Thomas sending out an invite to Amit saying, hey, I want to talk. Amit responds back with a 183. Ooh, what do you know? He responds back with more than one 183. He responds back with two 183s. What's that? Simulring. Amit has Simulring turned on. So this is an invite, an early media response that comes back from his link client and the call that's being established to his cell phone. Okay? If you were signed in with multi-point of presence to like four different endpoints, there would be four 183 session progresses here, right? Because we have to do early media for every one of those endpoints that you're signed into. So in this instance, we get two 183 session progresses because he has Simulring turned on. Great, well, let's dig in a little deeper here and see what we can see, because this is where it gets fun. And again, fun is a relative term. So, first thing to note is when I scroll down inside of the SDP, this is called the Session Description Protocol, I'm going to be faced with something that looks really scary. This is the candidates that show up in the SDP or the Session Description Protocol. And you're actually going to see two different sets of candidates in this instance. The first one you're going to see, I want to call your attention to, is this. MS Proxy 2007 Fallback. In the ICE draft, that is version 6, if I recall correctly. So this is an older version that was used in OCS 2007 R1. And we do also include it in R2 and Link for migration and interoperability purposes. It's kind of difficult to read as you scroll through it, so I tend not to do this version, but I scroll down a little bit further, and you're going to see, again, another set of ICE candidates that show up here. These are actually much easier to read, and this is the version 19 draft. This is the draft that Link uses, R2 uses, right? Why do we include both? Well, when Thomas made the call to Amit, he doesn't know if Amit's running a Link client or an R2 client or an R1 client. We don't know, so we send both. We're saying, I don't know which version of ICE you're going to like. I'm going to send you both. So here's the version 6. Here's the version 19. Here you go. So what can we learn from these? Well, first off, the numbers that you see here, 1, 2, 3, these are candidate pairs. Okay, candidates are always deployed out in pairs when we're looking at ICE. So I have candidate pair 1, and you can see that there are two candidates that go with this, 1 and 2. It is protocol UDP. Easy enough. The next really long number that you see here, it's a priority number. The higher the priority, the more we prefer it. Well, it's UDP, so that's a pretty high number, so it's a pretty high preference that we're going to use it. Then I see this address, 192.168.5.242. I see a couple ports, 2008 and 9, and then I see this type host. That means it's the IP addresses that are on my machine. That's the IP address I have, 5.242 in this trace. Now, why do I see two? One is for the RTP stream. One is for the RTCP stream. RTCP is real-time control protocol, right? That's the stream that we use for sending control information back and forth, right? So you ever wonder in your link client where you all of a sudden get that little pop-up that says, you know, poor network conditions are causing blah, blah. That's information that's bubbled up through the RTCP stream. Right? We're sending that information via that stream, and we're bubbling it up into the link client so that it's something user-friendly. Okay, so I have host addresses. Great. Second set of candidate pairs. Number two, I see TCP pass. That means TCP passive. That means for this particular set of candidates, I know that I can receive traffic on these candidates. Again, I've got a priority number. Here I have a wonderful IP address. 554449. Type, relay. Told you that word was going to come back to you. It's a relay address. It's a turn address, right? This is a turn allocation for me. That's the public IP address of the AV Edge server. It's a turn address, right? Next, I see pair three, again, UDP, type, relay. Turn address, right? Candidate pair four, TCP, ACT, that's active. That means this candidate pair, I can send traffic from this candidate pair. Type relay, okay? TCP active, same deal, but this time I get server reflexive. Stun, okay? Stun candidate, fantastic. And then last but not least, my candidate pair for UDP of server reflexive, that's stun. Incidentally, a little side note, in case you're paying attention, you'll notice that up here, the UDP ports are different, right? 8 and 9. Whereas the TCP ones are the same. And why is that? Well, because UDP is stateless, it's connectionless, right? We can't multiplex connections over the same port combination, right, with UDP. You can with TCP, right? So with TCP, we only have to allocate that one port because we can multiplex the connections through it, whereas UDP, we need a different one for media and RTCP, right? With UDP, we can do both. Or excuse me, with TCP, we can do both through the same port. Also, just as a side note, anything that you see to the right of this RADDR's reflexive address, generally, don't pay attention to that. It's a reflexive address that I would see, like when I'm making the request to, or when the front end's making the request into the stun server or the turn server, and we would then see that this is the address that made the request. It's not really helpful in troubleshooting. So generally speaking, anything to the right of, you know, the RADDR to the right, just ignore it, because it's not something that's necessarily going to be obvious to help you in this scenario. I get my 183 session progress back. Now, again, there were two of them. Look at the first one here. RTC 4.0 mediation server. This is the invite for the call that's going out to his cell phone, because that's going out via the mediation server. So I know that this is an early media dialogue that's going to the mediation server. That's his SIML ring to his cell. Here's the one that goes back to his client. You can see right here, user agent. That's a link client. Okay, so that's the second 183. So that's his client that's responding. So there's my two 183s. Excellent. Now I get the 200 okay. So the phones are ringing, right? Amit's link client is ringing. His cell phone's ringing. And he picks up the call, 200 okay. Right? When he answers the call, that's when we get the 200 okay that comes back. Now take a look in the 200 OK at the responses that we're getting. Looks really familiar, doesn't it? Except for the fact that if I look at this, wow, look at all those type hosts. A couple of 169. He's obviously got VMware or some virtualization software or something, right? That he's just doing something with lots of NICs that aren't connected to anything. But anyway, lots of candidates. But again, it's the same stuff that you guys saw before. Right? It's the ability for us to now exchange, these are the candidates that are coming back, on the other side from emit as part of the 200 OK. See, isn't this fun? I think it's great. This is just a screen cap showing you the information that would be in the SDP just for readability purposes. You can actually copy and paste that stuff and just paste it into Excel, and it pastes up very nicely. Just paste it in and do a space delimiter, and voila. And then you can sort it, and that way you can see which one's the higher priority and the lower, and so forth. It's kind of nice to be able to do that. Okay, so now we exchange candidates. Great. What about connectivity checks? Well, connectivity checks are all about determining all the possible UDP pairings and all the possible TCP pairings. Okay, we don't mix the two. We don't like try to do a UDP to a TCP or a TCP to a UDP, right? What are all the possible UDP port pairings that we can do, and what are all the possible TCP port pairings we can do? Stun packets are sent between these port pairs in order, based on how we see them in the candidate list. A stun packet response means that we have connectivity, right? So I may get a list of candidates, and I go, are you there? 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 And I'm trying to connect to all of them. And then if I send a connectivity check to a stun IP, and I get a response back from it, woohoo, I got connectivity. And as soon as that happens, boom, I stopped doing my checks because I have a candidate pair that gives me connectivity. Right? Remember we told you earlier with early media, it's not about finding the best, it's about finding a connection, because we don't want them picking up the phone and going hello and nobody's there, right? We want to be able to hear that. So we're going to do all of our connectivity checks and stop when a candidate pair is found that has bidirectional connectivity. Now, I said we want to get that quick. Quick doesn't mean best, right? How do we get the best candidates? That's called candidate promotion, right? So after you establish that call, that connection via early media, we're still going to continue doing connectivity checks in the background, right? We will select the highest order candidate that has validated connectivity, preferring UDP over TCP, of course preferring direct over relay. I should have mentioned that first. We always prefer direct communication, so if we happen to be on the same internal network, we're always going to prefer direct over relay and UDP over TCP. We send the SIP invite indicating that this is the only candidate now in the SDP. The 200 OK responds back with only one candidate because these are now the promoted candidates, one for RTP, one for RTCP. And media is now redirected to flow via the what we've determined to be optimal path. So what does that look like? So same conversation here. What I want you to notice in this window, as I click right over that, and zoom it, doesn't have fun. Here we go. Here's my initial invite, and look at the timestamp. 1308, 12.8. That's the original invite. Look at the re-invite that goes out. Right? So here's the, he picked up the call at 20 seconds. About 6 seconds later, I send out this re-invite. That's candidate promotion. That means that when you're testing things out, and I've seen all too many times this happen, you dial somebody, and they pick up on the other end, and you're like, great, the call happened, click, and you hang up. You didn't give it a chance to finish doing candidate promotion, so you're not seeing the whole story. Okay? Make the call, let them pick it up, and let it establish for 10 seconds, 15 seconds. Right? Generally, this will occur in about 10 seconds, is what we look for. And if you look at this invite, see what we've got here, right? This was the original 200 OK. Look at the re-invite that goes out. Check it out. Final candidate, one candidate pair. In this case, it happened to be UDP. It happened to be a server reflexive. So I know that in this instance, these two guys were able to talk via stun. And as it turns out, when these guys did the test, one of them was on hotel Wi-Fi. The other one was on the Wi-Fi at the Starbucks in the hotel. So it actually turned out that both of those networks were able to talk to each other via their stun addresses. So the edge server is not involved in the media path at all, right? The edge server was involved in signaling. We reflected the stun addresses. Great. But they were able to talk to each other without the need of the AV edge server. Oh, and in the 200 OK, incidentally, same thing, right? Same response back. Two candidates, UDP. And again, you've got this remote candidates line here, so that can help you to see what the other guy had picked. But again, we can see server reflexive. So I know both ends did server reflexive, so they're both talking via stun. and life's good. All right, we're almost there. Guys are still hanging with me. That's good. Let's talk a little bit about some more topology items with regards to how these connectivity checks work. You know, now again, on the left side here, we have home one, home two, right? So these could be two users that are both at home. These could be two users that are on the same home network, right? It could be, you know, me and one of my colleagues both working out of our home office, right? And he happened to come over and we're doing some work and whatever, and we both be behind the same firewall. Yeah, either way. On the right, we have a work one, which could be a link user, it could be an AVMCU, it could be mediation server, Exchange UM server, and then work two, which is just a regular link client. In the middle, you have your Access Edge and AV Edge, same disclaimer as before, same box, just different logical services, right? So start with the simple one, inside to inside. Users are both inside the network and they want to be able to talk to each other. Well, we allocate candidates like this, right? So there's work one. He allocates his local address, he allocates his stun addresses, the AV Edge server allocates turn addresses for him, and we're able to build up our candidate lists as needed. Now again, purple, yellow, purple being UDP, TCP for yellow, right? Work two, he builds up his candidate list. Now when it comes to connectivity, we would much prefer that we connect it just like we've drawn here. Whoop, because that's direct. But what happens if your customer has deployed firewalls internally between segments? Never happens, right? Looking at you. What happens if they deploy firewalls? What if those two users can't connect to each other directly, right? It's okay. It's not optimal, but it's okay because it's possible that they can actually reroute that connection through the edge. So this guy can actually connect in through the edge, right? Utilize that candidate that's available, which in turn would map to this candidate, which is available here, which comes back through, which connects into work too. So it's certainly feasible for us to hairpin through the edge server. It's not great to do that because obviously you're putting a lot more load on the edge server. It's not really meant to do this kind of scenario, but we would rather have media connectivity than not, so this is one way that we can get media connectivity for you. What if one's inside and one's outside, right? What does that do to the scenario? Well, same thing, we set up our candidates. He sets up his candidates. Obviously, direct connectivity is not going to work in this instance, right? So we have connectivity to, what is this? That's a stun address, right? So we have connectivity from stun. This is a port that happens to be available for work one, but that's on the AV edge. That's a turn candidate. It's okay, right? I have a stun address that's available to me. He has a turn candidate available to him. We can make the connection to this. Connection comes in really well. The implication here, of course, would be that turn connection is assuming the 50,000 port range is open, inbound, because that's what I'm connecting to here, right? These are candidates that are allocated on the 50,000 port range, 50,000 to 59999. So this is assuming that I can actually make a connection in to this 50,000 port range. Same thing for TCP, right? In the event that maybe they blocked UDP, but TCP was open, I could try that. In the event that neither of those are open, it's okay. We don't require the 50,000 port range to be open for this scenario to work, because I can send that traffic tunneled over UDP 3478, which will actually hairpin via the 50,000 ports that are there, back into work one. So the premise of this slide is, do I have to have the 50,000 port range open? No, you don't have to. Is it optimal? Yes, which we'll talk about later. But no, you don't have to have the port range open because we can make it work without it by tunneling that request through UDP 3478. Now, a key component to realize here, when we do this tunnel, you will never see port 3478 or port 443 as a candidate. Okay? You will still see this link client on the left sending it to whatever this high port was. Let's say it's 50,010. The request is still going to say that it's going to port 50,010. It's just going to be directed to UDP 3478. And when the AV Edge server gets it, he goes, oh, yeah, I know that. I allocated that port. That's this over here. And it knows how to turn that back around to get it into the client because he's the one that allocated it. And we're still having fun. Wait till we get to this good stuff. What about two outside clients, right? Same scenario, right? My outside clients have all of their candidates available. I've got my stun candidates. I have my turn candidates, right? My stun candidates again here. These are my stun candidates, right? These are my turn candidates that are on the AV Edge. We would most prefer to do that you see on the left side, direct connectivity. Could happen. Maybe we're both sitting at the same Starbucks, right? It's possible. May not be likely, but it's possible. Maybe we're on the same home network. Maybe we have this capability of doing stun to stun, right? We saw that in the trace that I showed you. That was an example of two server reflexive addresses that were able to talk to each other. That's much more optimal than going through Edge, right? Because we're keeping Edge out of the loop, right? Think about if we had to include Edge and Thomas is over in Europe and I'm over here in North America, right? But from an allocation standpoint, and I end up and travel over to where Thomas is, why would I want that traffic to come all the way back to my Edge server so that it can go all the way back across the pond? I don't want that. I'd much rather keep it local, and if I can't keep it local, I'd at least want to keep it in region, if you will. So if we have IP to IP connectivity via stun, it's going to make life a lot simpler. In the event that that stun connectivity is not available, of course, we will try to connect to the 50,000 port range. If that 50,000 port range isn't reachable, then we can still perform the same hairpin that you saw before, and that's what these little drawings are, this little drawing here. Right, is again, I would maybe come across this way, which would hairpin in, which would hairpin to this guy, you know, and draw my way back to H1, H2, and so forth. It's kind of hard to draw with this mouse. It doesn't help when you have like 10,000 lines on the screen either. So what about situations where you end up with versions of Edge that aren't running Link 2010? Like Office Communication Server 2007, just the R1 release, right? Well, with the 2007 Edge, this is edge to edge. Now, in this scenario, this edge to edge could be companies that are federated with each other, right? Or this could be me in North America using a North America Edge server, Thomas in Europe using a European Edge server, and the Edge servers talking to each other in that fashion, right? With R1, we need to talk on the 50,000 port range. We need to make a connection to the 50,000 port range. Either UDP, which is preferred. If that doesn't work, we'll try TCP. And if that doesn't work, we're done. Right? The R1 environment doesn't understand tunnel mode. That's why if you look at our documentation, we'll say for the 50,000 port range, if you're going to federate with someone that's running R1, you need to open that port range. Because it doesn't understand how to do this tunnel mode. It's just not there. When you introduce an R2 or a link edge, now we have this capability of doing AV Edge tunnel mode, which means that, again, in this instance, I build out my candidates. I have the capability, if I can't connect over port 50,000 or what have you, I can tunnel that traffic via port UDP 3478 edge to edge. And in the event that UDP was closed down, of course, we would use TCP 443 as a fallback. But this gives me the capability, as you can see, of performing hairpinning to this 50,000 port range because I can come in via this UDP 3478 port and have it actually tunneled. Now, if you want to actually see that, you got to open up Netmon to do that, right? You're going to have to fire up Netmon and actually look at, there you can see how we're doing the candidate checks, as well as actually seeing it tunneled inside of a turn packet, right? Because like we said, it's not like we're going to address that to UDP 3478. We're still going to address it to port 50,080. It's just going to happen to arrive on UDP 3478, and the Edge server is going to know what to do with it. Fallback would be to use TCP. Another interesting scenario comes into play here. Let's say we're not doing a fallback for TCP, but let's say we're doing, desktop sharing, right? With regards to desktop sharing, right, desktop sharing needs TCP, right? Well, we can't tunnel like we do with UDP 3478 with TCP 443. It doesn't work that way. So the way that we have to solve that is we actually will make a connection from this edge server to this edge server on TCP port 443, but our source port will be TCP 50,000 whatever. We send it with a source port of TCP 50,000 whatever so that the return traffic comes back on 50,000. We can't have the return traffic come back on 443. The edge server wouldn't know what to do with it. So when that traffic is sent edge to edge, we source it, source port 50,000 range, destination port 443. That's a tricky one that we'll cover again in a couple slides. What happens when we mix and match? Well, you know, R2 edge or link edge with a 2007 edge. Well, again, we allocate all of our candidates here. We try to do that, and the R1 edge goes, what? I'm not sure what you're talking. So that fails. 3478 fails. If we try to do that and it's blocked, now we got a problem, right? Because if I try to connect sourced 50,000 into port 443 and that's blocked, well, now what do I do? Well, I try to do 50,000 to 50,000, and of course, if that's blocked, then I'm done. That's the only options that I have for connecting to the R1 edge environment. So you have to keep that in mind when you're federating with other companies that might still be running a 2007 RTM or R1 version. So the 50,000 port range is always a great discussion point because security guys don't like it. They see a range of 10,000 ports and they go, no, I'm not going to open that. And they don't realize that the edge server, as you should have learned in this session by now, isn't listening on those 10,000 ports, right? It's allocating those ports as necessary. The ports are only allocated via the ability of the client to have credentials. And on top of that, candidate checks and promotions happen inside of 10 seconds. So at best, that port range, that particular port, is going to be open for about 10 seconds and requires a username and password to be able to get access to. So security guys that typically tell me, well, I'm not going to open that up because that's 10,000 ports and we don't open that many because it's a security risk. We sit them down and explain to them, well, let me tell you how those 10,000 ports are being used. We're not saying open them up for anybody to connect to them and do what they want. So minimum requirements. Key point here, minimum. There's a difference between minimum and optimal, right? Minimum requirements are to interop with a 2007 AV Edge server, you need UDP 3478, TCP 443 inbound, and the 50,000 port range, both inbound and outbound, for UDP and TCP. That's what we need, because R1 Edge doesn't understand how to do tunnel mode. So without that, not happening. For R2, we need UDP 3478, TCP 443, that's not different, inbound. We need UDP 3478 outbound. That's new, right, because we introduced this new tunnel mode, so we need to be able to reach out on destination 3478 UDP. At a minimum, we need TCP, the 50,000 port range outbound as a source, right? That's because we're making the outbound connection on 443. But we need as a source the 50,000 port range, so it'll allow the response traffic to come back in. And then the UDP TCP 50,000 port range if you're going to interop with R1 edges. If you're not going to interop with R1 edges, well, then you don't need to have that port range open. Minimal requirements, okay? This is not what I lead off with customers, by the way. Okay, because if you lead off with this, they're like, sold, and you're done. And now you're going, but I want to, it's optimal. And you're like, well, you said that's the minimum, so that's what I'm going to give you. Let's talk about why minimum isn't such a great idea, why it's called minimum. I shouldn't say it's such a great idea. Let's explain why it's called a minimal configuration. So take this scenario here. We have two different clients. In this instance, two different clients are using two different edge servers. Now, this could be, quite simply, me in North America using my North American edge server, Thomas in Europe using his European edge server. It could be me and Javed, both in North America, But we have an Edge pool that has 5 Edge servers in it. And I'm using Edge Server 1, and he's using Edge Server 3. Okay, so this scenario applies not just Edge pool to Edge pool. This scenario would apply inside of an Edge pool as well. Because you're not using the pool, you're allocated to a server during that process. Right? So I could get on 1, he could get on 4. So keep that in mind. Obviously, this could also be federation too. I mean, that's the most obvious example. Where's the fun in that? So on the left, the port range is open. Obviously, direct connection is preferred. It doesn't work. So I make my connection on 3478 UDP or TCP 443. He's going to try and connect to the 50,000 port range. He can connect to that port on the same Edge server that I'm on, because that's where my candidate is, and life is good. Optimal media path, right? Optimal in the sense that direct wasn't there, so the next best optimal path was we're using the same Edge server. And likewise, I could go the other way. Right? It could go the other way in the sense that if Javed were calling me and we were using the other Edge server, same deal. But the purpose here is with the port range open, we're refining that traffic down to just one Edge server. Now with the port range closed, watch what happens. We try to make the connection. Well, that dies. I make my connection on 3478 because I'm calling Javed. I connect to my Edge server on UDP 3478 or TCP 443. Javed now tries to connect to me on the 50,000 port range, and it doesn't work. What's Javed going to do now? He's going to connect to his own Edge server on UDP 3478, TCP 443, and we are going to hairpin or tunnel between edge to edge. Now, that could be, again, I'm on Edge Server 1, he's on Edge Server 4 in the same edge pool, server-to-server traffic. Now, you might be wondering, well, Brian, that's just silly. Why doesn't Javed just connect to port 3478 on that top Edge server? It's not his Edge server. You can only connect to 3478 UDP or 443 TCP of your Edge server, the one that you're provisioned with when you sign into your client. So I got provisioned with server 1. I can't connect to server 4 on UDP 3478. That's not the server I got provisioned in. Okay, so you got to keep that in mind, because now we end up with this hairpin. Now, okay, in the same data center, great. Between data centers, maybe not so hot, right? Okay. Last component talks about load balancer usage outside, and a key piece to realize here has to do with the certificate, the AV auth certificate. Right? We tell you when you deploy Edge that you must make sure that you are using the same certificate across all of your Edge servers in a pool. That's not just the same cert itself, that's the same cert and private key. So you have to export the private key from Edge Server 1 and then import that exact same certificate on servers 2, 3, 4, 5, all the servers in the same pool. Why? Well, because that certificate is what's used when we provision MRAS credentials. So here I am, I'm signed in, and I got an MRAS token from AV Edge Server 1. And I've allocated, some information. I'm going to go set up a call. But at the time I go to set up a call, we have a bit of a problem with AV Edge Server 1. Well, that's okay. I mean, we have a hardware load balancer. We just get balanced to another Edge server, right? Well, when I get balanced to the second AV Edge server, I'm going to pass him my credential information, which was encrypted by the AV Edge auth certificate. Well, if that's not the same certificate on both sides, how's that second Edge server going to be able to decrypt the credentials request that I sent in? It's not going to work. This is why you need to have the AV auth certificate be the same on all of your Edge servers that are in the pool. Very critical. That way it'll let me allocate my UDP and TCP candidates. Otherwise, if I try to allocate those candidates, my credentials that I pass along are just going to be junk because it doesn't know how to decrypt them. So troubleshooting, to wrap up, inbound provisioning without MRAS, right? You look at your logs, and you do MRAS, and you enter, and you get nothing. Well, that means that an AV Edge server is not configured for the pool. Go into Topology Builder, go to the pool, tick the checkbox for external media, pick the Edge pool, publish it, off you go. MRAS credentials are not provided. That's usually a connectivity issue between the front-end server and the Edge server, and it's typically 5062 TCP. That's the problem. No stun or turn candidates. No connectivity between the client and the AV Edge server on the respective ports. right? Maybe you've got the wrong AV edge FQDN. Look at the MRAS provisioning. Remember, I saw mine, av3.whatever.microsoft.com, right? Look at that. Maybe somebody fat-fingered it. Or maybe they put the name in there and they forgot to put the name in the public DNS. Could be something as simple as that. Obviously, either one of these situations, you could have a firewall in the way. There's always a firewall in the way, right? Turn candidates show internal NATed IP address. Oops, right? But again, it's good to see. Suddenly you see it in the log and you're like, what? Why am I seeing a turn candidate with a 10.0.0.5? That ain't right. Right? Well, that means that the AV edge server is not aware of the external IPs, right? It is possible to NAT edge servers. That's fine. But you still have to properly configure them so that the edge servers know their public IP addresses. Otherwise, if you just make everything private and never educate the topology about the public IPs, well, the turn server is just going to hand out what it knows. Well, it doesn't know its public IP. So here's where you get the logs from. The live meeting entry that's there works well for the live meeting client. Once you install Link, that doesn't help. That only helps for the live meeting client itself. And this is just a screen that shows you a quick summary of the terms that I use. You know, I search for MRAS. You can search for MRAS URI. I just search for credentials, and I just search for candidate. But this is a good refresher that kind of shows what you should be looking for when you're digging into the logs. And we made it. And y'all are still here, and you didn't fall over. That's great. So this is a good session on what the AV Edge server is all about and how we find our optimal media path and how we read these log files. Very important information for being able to troubleshoot. I hope you found it interesting. I did, but I don't get out much. Hope you understand the call flows, and it is there to help you troubleshoot. We've got lots of related content. Thank you. Thank you much. We have lots of related content. You can find me later at the Learning Center. I'm also doing a session tomorrow on Link in the Enterprise, and then after that I'll be over in the Learning Center. We'll open it up to questions. For those of you that have to split out to your next session, please don't forget to fill out your evals. And I thank you all for your attention. If you got questions, step up to the mic.
Working? Yeah. Yeah. How would MRAS know the public IP addresses of hardware load balancers being on the public side of the edge servers?
So if you have a hardware load balancer, your edge servers will all have public IP addresses. You would not NAT. So you would have public IP addresses for the VIPs that are assigned to the hardware load balancer, and then each of the edge servers would all have public IP addresses. We don't support NATing with hardware load balancers.
All right. Thanks.
Why is there that long delay between the first exchange of the candidate lists and the candidate promotion?
Well, I wouldn't call it a long delay. I mean, 4 seconds isn't, I don't think it's a very long delay, but
it's enough time usually for users to say hello, hello, hello.
Yeah, but when we're doing that candidate promotion, we've already established media before that. So you're saying hello and I'm hearing you. The candidate promotion is just now about optimizing that path. So I may have chosen a path that went, you know, edge to edge or something to that effect. And then I was able to optimize it and suddenly like a firewall rule lit up or whatever and I'm able to do stun, you know, stun to stun, and that's more optimal.
I mean, but so what's going on during that time?
What's going on during that time?
Yeah.
I mean, from the client's perspective, you don't notice. You're just talking and you're having a conversation and you're doing your thing. And Link in the background is checking to make sure it's optimal. And if it isn't, it'll switch the candidates over automatically. And if it is, then it just final candidates and off you go. Most times what you'll find is the candidates that it picks are usually the candidates that are the optimal ones.
Okay.
It rarely switches, but it's capable of doing so.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If you have multiple link pools and multiple link edges, in normal operations, each pool would use their respective edge, correct? And then if one edge failed, would both pools know about the working edge, or would only
no? So in that scenario, the pool that has the edge server that decided to take a dirt nap, they would lose the ability to do external connectivity through AV. That pool would not be able to use this edge unless you went back into Topology Builder and you said, "Hey, this front end pool now needs to use this AV edge because the trust isn't there." The Topology Builder says that it's these pools to these edges,
right?
And if he's not there, he doesn't know to go trust this guy. So those guys would just be shot down.
All right, thanks.
Sure.
Is
We just wanted you to walk further, that's all.
Is there a way to tell if a client is hairpinning without enabling a trace or looking at the edge server?
Is there a way to tell if the client is hairpinning?
Through the edge server.
Well, you can take a look and see what... First, you would see what the candidates are that they're utilizing. And then at the end of the day, if you wanted to be able to see, is it actually connecting on 50,000 or not, you'd need some kind of sniffer or something. Because the SDP is just going to show the 50,000 port, but you'd have to have Netmon on the client to actually see the request go to 3478 instead of to the 50,000 port range.
Yeah,
so Netmon would be sufficient on the client, and you'd be able to figure it out.
There's just not an easy way to, without...
No, because it's just tunneled, so as far as we know, we're still connecting to the turn, 50,000 port range. It just happens to be packaged up.
What if you have clients across hundreds of VLANs, or tens of thousands of clients across hundreds of VLANs? You have to open up 50,000 through 60,000 to allow direct communication between all those VLANs?
No, I mean, the implication there would be that clients that connect to each other directly would have the large port range, and I mean anything over 1024, open between them. If that's not available and they have to hairpin through Edge, well, then they need to be able to connect to 3478 UDP or 443 TCP on Edge, and that's all they need to do.
You could just size your Edge accordingly, or is
you could size your Edge accordingly. The trick to that is we don't have any official guidance on how to size for that, so it'd be kind of a let's try it and see, and then when you release the magic smoke out of the back of the box, you go, well, that wasn't big enough, and you know, try again.
Thanks. Great session.
Sure, sure. Thank you.
So in one of your last slides, you had a scenario where the internal user picked an MRAS of you had two DNS edge servers, or two edge servers in the pool. The internal client chose edge 1, and external client chose edge 2, and 50,000 port range was closed, and they both connected on UDP 3478 to their own respective edge servers.
Yes.
How did the two edge servers relay the traffic between them?
Oh, so that was this one? Let me make sure I'm on the right slide here. Pictures are worth 1,000 words when you're talking these kind of things. Not there. It was this one, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it's tunneled. So it's either going to be UDP 3478 to UDP 3478 or 443 to 443.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Sure.